Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Say some more stuff that Gavin might use on the podcast.
Blah, blah, blah. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. 1, 2, farts, 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 and tits.
And then you push stop or yep. What?
I'm JP, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah, recorded live in the Jeanette D. Moses Memorial Studio. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On today's episode, Hank III, Weller Bookworks Book Collector Salon, and Epic Brewing. The Williams family has been a staple in the country scene since the 30s, starting with Hank Williams, followed by his son Hank Jr., and finally Hank III. Hank III is a country and punkabilly singer from Nashville who burst onto the scene with the 1999 album Rise and Outlaw. In September of 2011, he released three albums on the same date, Ghost to a Ghost / Guttertown, Three Bar Ranch Cattle Callin', and Attention Deficit Domination. Slug writer James Oram recently chatted with Hank III on the phone while he was out on his current tour.
You kind of seem to be coming at your country stuff a little bit differently. Did that kind of come along with the freedom of being your own record label now?
Well, part of that, yeah, was one of the reasons it's a different, you know, I'm the first one to tell you there's only maybe five real pure country songs on that, and the rest of it is a lot more different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Since I had a record with, Dave Sherman from Earthrod, Tom Waits, Les Claypool, some of my inspiration from Alan King at Hellstomper, I wanted to put out a record, you know, and I've always been someone, you can't just pigeonhole me, but
oh, exactly.
That record does have a lot of different sounds, moods, highs, and lows on it, and I wanted to go just way beyond and take it to the next level. Even a song like I Don't Want to Go Home, in general, I had that written for, a duet with hopefully Joan Jett, but, you know, that's not even... You know, that's on the borderline of a soft rock, emo kind of song. There's songs like Day by Day and Outlaw Convention that have a little more of the old school country feel to it. But then all the Cajun stuff, that's going back and being a little more pure because Cajun music and honky-tonk go hand in hand and have a very long history. And that is a style of music that has definitely kind of gotten not every, you know, it's just like jazz or bluegrass. It's a special kind of music.
Well, and it was really cool to hear it because, I mean, you adding your flavor to it and the countryside to hear the accordion in a country song is always really cool. I don't know why more people don't do it. I don't know why it's kind of been kind of forgotten about, but like you said, it's there just as much as the blues or anything else.
I've always felt, I mean, there's been a natural progression with Hank Williams and Louisiana, and then my father being born in Louisiana, then me working with a lot of the rock bands out of Louisiana, so it was a natural thing for me, aside from what all that music does for me on a personal level.
Mm-hmm. Now that you are your own record label, I guess it's pretty good sign that, I guess, any restraints have been let go because you, like I said, released so much material last year and so such diverse material. What did you find were like the immediate benefits of being on your own record label?
Well, the best thing is I only have to go through one lawyer opposed from going through five.
Mm-hmm.
And even with Curb Records, on the last few records, I would make my record, turn it in, and see what they have a problem with. And I would do 100% control of my art and then see what they had a problem with. But that's what it boils down to. Oh, and I have an option to work with another musician. I can do it. I don't have to be held back. If I have a chance to be on a True Blood episode, a song on that, I don't have to be shot down by Curb Records. They took so much work away from me and held so much creativity. They were just, it doesn't matter if it's me, Tim McGraw, Leon Rimes, the same problems are there with every artist that works with them. And it's not me just being a young punk telling them to fuck off. I did not make them that money, but someone like Tim McGraw has made them over $100 million, and they're still greedy, and they're still not satisfied. So they're just not in the good business, and they're not into respecting their artists.
That's very apparent because, I mean, basically, I think with you, they had somebody they couldn't, you know, like you said, pigeonhole. They couldn't force you into a mold or anything like that and make you be like, you know, let's make you the next Brad Paisley or whoever is, you know.
I've just always known my sound. I don't need a producer to tell me how to write a song. I don't need someone to tell me to do this. I write songs for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not being selfish. You know, I try to relate to some people out there and put some songs out for some people to identify with, but I'm not going in an office and trying to pump out 10 songs a day and doing a marketing plan to get this song on the radio. Good music will push itself.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And that's, I'm a very strong believer in that. Back in the days when DJs were able to play what they wanted to play because it was exciting to them, was a great time. And now, throughout the years, that's all been taken away as far as FM radio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, internet radio, thank God, it's there. Kids, men, women are able to play music that they identify with and that touches their spirit and are able to put more underground artists out there, more people that are true to the art form.
I found country music through people like yourself and, you know, listening to people that would, you know, delve into country music, some of the punk rockers that would, like Mike Ness's Social Distortion puts out a country record here and there. And but, like, I listen to you and I go, okay, now I want to find out all these guys that he's talking about. I want to know who, you know, Johnny Paycheck or, you know, all the names you've mentioned in songs and in liner notes. Do you take some pride in being that kind of ambassador to genuine country or classic country, whatever you want to call it?
Well, I take pride in that I was able to open up for Johnny Paycheck. I was able to know Johnny Paycheck. I was able to know Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash and David Allan Coe is like a grandfather to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all these people have taken me under their wing more of because they see how what I've had to do. Or singing with George Jones on stage, man, I've sung with a lot of the old legends, Willie Nelson. So to be able to know them and to be part of that history and to offer a little bit of inspiration to kids out there with what I do means a lot, for sure. That's the biggest thing is, you know, we miss them. And I know I'm outside of the box and I'm strange and all that, but I had to do something different. My grandfather and my father has covered country music as well as it can be covered, and I'm just being myself, being natural, and what I think is good for me and what I do, just to carve my own niche.
Mm-hmm. Speak of being different and, you know, strange, it seems like you almost become a different person when it comes to your heavy metal side and the more aggressive music. Would you say that, like, your inspiration comes from the same places when it comes to country and metal, or is it a completely different process, I guess?
It's just a love for the music, man. You know, I love playing drums. I love playing guitar. I love playing bass. I love gear, you know, pedals. And I'm involved in every aspect of it. You know, I'm recording, writing, mixing, loading the trailer, setting the stage up. It all comes from a love of the craft more than anything. I'm not just even my son would be like, you're involved with all angles of it. It's not like you're just strapping on a guitar and walking out on stage.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of in-betweens. Like that guy that I had here yesterday was like a legendary guitar tech and just had just tons of knowledge, and that's why it was so important that I had to really sit down and talk with him and pick up some of the things that he had to offer me, because I might not ever be around that guy again. And there's, I don't know, I would just say me being a drummer and the love of music in general has helped a lot with my different styles. Yeah.
about, like, kind of following your career and listening to records and stuff, where you kind of took the path of most resistance, but I think you've made better and more original and creative music because of it. But do you ever feel like you kind of tore up the lottery ticket because you have the name, it takes less talent and less energy and less creativity to conform and make the records that they're making today and just be, you know, Hank Williams' grandson that also plays country and Hank Jr.'s son, and you're just gonna be cookie cutter and do everything that they say, and you could have made a lot of money? And do you ever feel like you kind of tore up a lottery ticket, or not a missed opportunity, because I don't believe you would ever, you know, sell yourself short like that?
I've written hit songs. I already know that. Just because they're not hit songs isn't my problem. And to me, the way I look at it is, if you look at the family name and the family history and the family money, I shouldn't have to sell out on either side of my family, on the farming side of my family or my dad's side of the family. That should be, it is what it is. So I've never really done it for money. Yeah, I've done it to get by. I've had to file bankruptcy not even 10 years ago just to keep it rolling. And, you know, I had a one-night stand, waited 3 years to tell me I had a kid and had to pay off that $70,000 debt and all kinds of stuff. But I know I've done it different outside of the established, outside of the music business, and I've carved my own niche. And people that were writing about me in the early 90s that were saying I was just riding the coattails, they now know that this kid's in it for the long haul. Where most people would have called it quits and tucked their tail between their legs, I've been standing up and fighting and still doing it to it. That loyalty and that rowdy fan base that I have, all those special things that I have at my show, no one else out there, some do, but not really, they can never have that underground rawness that I have because I've stuck to my gun. And it goes back to, a good song will push itself, good music will push itself, and the beauty of it all, don't be too big, don't be too small, and you'll have longevity. And that's why bands like the Melvins and the Reverend Horton Heat, all these other bands that some people would say they just never did get the respect that they deserved, and the other folks know, you just can't deny it. As someone told me the other day, I don't care what industry you're in. If you've been doing it more than 20 years and you're still around doing what you do, that says it all right there.
Yeah, you're successful.
So,
well, and you kind of reminded me of something I once heard Lemmy say from Motorhead. He said, we may not have a lot of fans in America, but the ones we do have would kill for us. And so I think you're speaking right to that, where it's like, you may only have, in a big market, or even like a market like Salt Lake, you may only have 500 big fans, and but those 500 people will show up every time you come and play. Every time.
No doubt, man. And, you know, the only reason I bring up the Hank Jr. thing is, you know, he has said in interviews before, oh, the hardest thing I ever have to do is open my mailbox. That being said, I'll be, you know, doing my thing until the end, and I don't expect being in the will or any of that stuff, but just that alone says it all.
Hank III will be passing through Salt Lake on September 3rd at In the Venue. For more information on the tour, the album, and his career, visit him online at hank3.com. Gentry Densley on guitar and Tyler Smith on drums form Salt Lake City's doom metal duo Eagle Twin. They receive favorable national acclaim for their debut album, The Unkindness of Crows, in the summer of 2009, and extensively toured thereafter to support it. The group is back, releasing their second full-length album on August 28th on Southern Lord Records. From that album, The Feather-Tipped, The Serpent's Scale, here's Epilogue, Crow's Theology. Thank you. That was Epilogue, Crow's Theology, from the second full-length album from Eagle Twin, The Feather Tipped, The Serpent's Scale. The band is currently preparing for a tour of New Zealand and Australia with Russian Circles this September. For more information on the group, check out our July 2012 issue featuring an article on the duo. Sam Weller's was a Main Street fixture until leaving their historic location in 2011 to become Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. The relocation has led to more interaction in the community and reaching out to younger readers with new elements like a website. And in June of 2012, the shop started holding book collector salons on the last Friday of every month for fellow readers to meet each other and discuss rare books over food and drinks. Slug writer Johnny Logan sat down with namesake owner Tony Weller about the salons and what he hopes to achieve with them.
Tony, can you tell us a little bit about what the Book Collector Salon is?
Yeah, the Collector's Book Salon is really a social event for people who love books in the, beyond their content, but whose affection for books have moved on to the physical object, which I think is where readership kind of dovetails with history and art. So one reason I stuck with the business of my family is when I was a young man in college and had been waiting for many years for humanity to catch up with my sensibilities, I realized that humanity wouldn't, because I had been reared in an environment that was dominated by people of the book, by readers, booksellers, publishers, printers, authors, people who read more than normal. And it skewed my judgment of humanity into thinking that people were brighter, more open-minded, more creative, more open to exchange of ideas than they truly were. And that's why I stuck with the book business, because I realized some of the best people I'd ever met, I had met in my parents' business. It was the most enlightened environment I experienced as a young man. You know, over the years, I've met a lot of people who read and write and collect books. And they are the thinkingest, most interesting people in the world, because everyone's personality is built from family, from school, from friendships, and the media to which we are exposed. You know, mostly television, I fear. But the reader adds to that group of influences great thinkers and dreamers from all of history, because with the book we're able to bridge chasms of time and geography. And when I think of the great influences in my life, certainly there's people I knew who had great bearing on the fellow I would become. But I think there are more influences in my life that come from books, from people who may have died before my birth or spoke a language that I do not share. And I think that is fairly magical, to be able, for me, a Utah kid, to become a Zen Buddhist because of the writings of Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, to become an anarchist because of the writings of Emma Goldman and Kropotkin, to explore weird art and, take a 180-degree turn from math and science towards literature and art because of people like Hans Richter and John Cage. I feel very strongly about the influence of books in my life, and I guess I have a hope for society that people can share the richness of the human experience, through reading. But in my years in the bookstore, I've met remarkable people, and every day I come to work, this is my 34th year working in the family business, and I have a good time, which is not to say it's just a bowl of cherries. I mean, certainly when I think about money, it's a little tougher, because the book trade is not a lucrative trade. It never has been, and is actually right now as challenging as it's ever been. But I meet wonderful thinkers and people each day on a one-on-one basis. And it occurred to me that in our time, especially the digital era, that people are to some degree losing the ability to interact with one another in a conversational sense, that an increasing ratio of interaction between people seems to be through text messaging or Facebook, but that there's a richness to the human experience, when you're face to face with someone, that can't be denied. As a sort of lay student of Marshall McLuhan, I also worry about the social and psychological effects of a generation whose main connections occur through the internet. It's got to have an effect, and I suspect it won't be a good one. And so I felt like you know, what can we do with our business that would be, yes, you know, good for the bookstore, but also bring some of these phenomenal readers and collectors, thinkers, and dreamers together to create a social affair that is meaningful, you know, to these people. And we came up with the Collector's Book Salon. And it's, you know, great. At each of these events, I've had customers I know and a few visitors I've never met, which is nice, and heard amazing conversations taking place. You know, there's these two kind of biblio nerds that I know, and at the first event, you know, one of them was talking about, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and made some comments that pertained to a guy who was just across the room, who I might identify as, you know, the top of his field in our community. And he said, well, wow, I would love to meet this fellow on some occasion. I said, oh, that's him. And I just kind of pointed across the room. And so, you know, I took him over and did a little introduction and, you know, left them conversing with one another. And so, you know, it's a way to bring the thinkers and the bibliophiles of the community together. It's also a way for people who may be enjoying the art of the book, the history, the fetishism of a book, into an environment where they can meet people who may share their lonely interests, because reading, book collecting, writing, in fact, you know, they're largely solitary activities.
Now, as far as the event goes, it was originally just planned for June and July. What kind of made you expand this, and do you know how long you're going to continue it?
We don't. I'm afraid we're not wealthy enough to throw parties just for our own amusement, and so we set what we consider to be the low bar of measurement for success at just selling enough books in that evening to the people in attendance to pay for the food and drinks that we supplied. We're content to break even. I mean, we'd love to make money, and we certainly need it. We felt like if the event could fund itself, that we would call it good. And the two events have hit that mark. And so we not only had a good time, and several other people had a good time, we liked the idea of making it a regular affair. We were just too nervous to commit to a monthly affair without some evidence that enough members of the community appreciated and enjoyed the event for it to be affordable. Now we're going to carry it on. The idea is that we'll do it monthly, but you know, if attendance dwindles and interest falls off, we probably won't keep doing it. But I like to think that it can be a monthly affair where those misfits and biblio nerds, those book collectors, those loners and misanthropes can all get together and wonder about each other. You know, a whole bunch of great thinkers thinking different thoughts. It's pretty interesting.
Nice. Now, I had a chance to speak with you just before you guys moved over here to Charlie Square. How are things going since the move? And, you know, you're liking the new space. How are things working out?
I love the new space. It's still a tenuous business. You know, we still struggle for, you know, getting enough customers in the store for us to feel like our store and our livelihood is secure. And I just, I've been part of the anti-Wall Street movement for a lot of my adult life. I'm afraid the suspicions I had as a young man now just seem like facts. But I'm encouraged because I think a growing number of citizens are starting to recognize that we can't throw all of our cultural interest towards the corporate colonialists of our time. And I see people really longing for local businesses. You know, some of them just miss the diversity that having a bunch of different local businesses represented. Others, you know, may get more soundly the economic basis for supporting local businesses. Because clearly, if your neighbor has no work and no income, he can't support whatever endeavor you do to earn your living. And so, you know, while we may feel gleeful about cheap stuff, our cheap purchasing somehow is destroying the livelihoods of other people in our own community. you know, they can't really support what we do. And so, you know, I'm seeing more people making socially conscious purchasing decisions. You know, I would like to think that we get our share of that. So, you know, it's Trolley Square is improving. You know, it's been a mall that's had a little bit too many vacancies. But since we moved in, I mean, we came in right after Whole Foods. You know, my heart really goes out to local businesses more than anyone. My favorite neighbors when I moved in were Tabula Rasa and Desert Edge and Cabin Fever, you know, the local places that I think about. But since we've moved in, we've got a supernatural vegan, you know, cook-free mm-hmm. cafe over on 6th East. And we just had Spark open up. They have really cool clothing here with us. And Best Friends Animal Sanctuary has moved in. And I'm an animal lover. Most of the animal groups get a little donation from me periodically. This is my great hope for Trolley Square. Also the Spectacle, you know, a great local glass. I got these glasses from the Spectacle. Sorry, my friends at Image Eyes, I kind of split my business between these two places. You know, my hope for the mall, because I think City Creek and Gateway are probably going to be more successful at landing big chain stores, that this could self-identify as a local business kind of destination. It's really well placed in the northeast quadrant of the city where, gratefully, there isn't enough room for another big box development. I was pretty sad at what happened in Sugar House. I'm still sad at what's gone on in Sugar House. But you couldn't build, you know, all those big box things on the east side of Highland Drive without something going wrong on the west side. It was just a matter of time. But in this part of the city, it's closely developed. And I would like to think that the owners of the mall would just set their sights on filling this with as many cool local businesses as they could. They have free parking, which is a great advantage. And it's super convenient for everyone from Central City through the avenues to Federal Heights and Sugar House, the University District. And so, you know, I have a sense that this is going to be a cool place in the future. It's also old enough that it has a character that the modern built malls, may, you know, build through investment in architecture, but it's an old trolley barn and it's really cool. And we had a lot of fun, you know, with our interior, you know, with our high ceilings and bringing in the street lights that are salvaged from downtown Salt Lake City once upon a time. You know, we're pretty happy to be here. I'm very happy, in fact, and I think the store is the right size for the digital era. We've seen losses in certain segments of the book business more than others, and we've done our best to design our store around the changed culture in which we exist now. So, I think Trolley Square is improving. I would encourage any local business people who want a location to please come and talk to these people here, because I really want you as my neighbors. We've also failed to fill our coffee shop. You know, we have a 1,300 square foot area where we really intended to have a coffee shop, cafe, bistro, you know, opium den. Oh, no, you can't do that anymore. Something interesting in there, but we've not done that yet, and we are still working on that, although I've kind of backed away because some other things have claimed my attention. But I'm signed on for another 11 and a half years here. And that space needs to be filled. And as you know, this isn't bad coffee, but we walked across the plaza to Whole Foods to get some coffee. I would much prefer to just walk downstairs and, you know, get it in our own coffee shop. And so, you know, we hope somebody will step forward and look at the space. We have a long enough lease here that we can provide them with a pretty good deal, and be somebody subleasing from us rather than directly from Trolley Square, because that's part of my lease. The bad news is I'm paying for 1,300 vacant square feet, and I'd like to fill that with something. You know, we built it with two entrances into the bookstore and an independent entrance to accommodate the possibilities of early morning business if someone wanted to be open earlier than we were, or late business if they wanted to stay open later. So, we'll keep working on that.
The next salon will be taking place this Friday, August 31st, from 7 p.m. until closing. For more information on the shop, visit them online at wellerbookworks.com. joined once more by managing editor Esther Moronio for a weekly daily calendar rundown. Thanks, Esther.
Thank you.
It's really great to have you back again to talk all things going on this week, August 28th to September 3rd. I'm most excited, of course, about Tank Girl.
Tank Girl, yes. It's Dr. Sketchy's anti-art school, which happens once a month and is organized by our very own Maggie Z. If you're interested in art, you can actually go and they'll have some models there, and this show is themed. So what do you think Tank Girl means?
Tank Girl is actually a reference to a comic book character and most infamously a character from of the same comic of a movie in the 90s that did not do well.
Oh.
With a Gwen Stefani prototype. Gavin knows what I'm talking about.
It'll probably make for some pretty awesome costumes to draw, though.
Oh, definitely. It's just $5. It's at 7 p.m.
You can go to the Metro and take your art supplies and draw some awesome models.
Are you a drawer?
No.
No.
You should see me try to play on Draw Something.
I'd like to.
It's pretty sad.
But you have done it?
You should play me. Are you on Draw Something?
I'm not really into apps.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, because you don't have an iPhone.
Gavin is.
All right, Gavin, let's play on Draw Something.
And Wednesday, August 29th, Chelsea Wolf, Light Black, and Spell Talk will be at Urban Lounge. It's experimental folk rock. I'm sure you're familiar with Spell Talk. Do you know any of these groups?
I've heard of Chelsea Wolf, but I'm not familiar with Light Black.
Light Black is great.
Really?
Go check it out. And Thursday, August 30th, I know you're more excited about this than anybody else. Why don't you tell people what's going on then?
Oh my God, people, it's Mike Brown Fest number 7 at Urban Lounge. If you've ever been to Mike Brown Fest, which I have unfortunately not been to, but I've heard stories, and it's a pretty crazy time at Urban Lounge. They actually let Mike Brown and his friends skate inside of Urban Lounge. There will also be tomato throwing at the band. The Fucktards will be playing. And you can get the newest copy of Mike Brown's zine. Have you ever been to Mike Brown Fest?
Yeah.
Is it as crazy as it sounds?
Yes. In a word, yes.
Mike Brown once gave me a copy of his other zine.
Women, duh. Or Men,
yeah.
Duh. Yeah.
He made me pay for it, too.
Those are some classics. Those are good. I'm a big fan of the initial Women, Duh. I have not read the follow-up. And Friday, August 31st, Hellbound Glory and Jackie Pervo will be at Burt's. It's only $7 and it's at 10 p.m. What do you have to lose, Esther?
You know what I have to lose?
What?
A good time in L.A. for FYF Fest, which is where I'm going to be.
Oh, okay. No, I like what you did there. You really kept us going. And we didn't know where you were gonna turn that one with, and then you went to L.A. on that.
I did. I apologize because...
Pulled the classic L.A. route on us.
It's not a local event.
Thanks. Well, now you've promoted it, and everything's fucked. I hope you're happy with this bed you've made.
For those of you who will not be in L.A., on Saturday, September 1st, you can go to the Suicycles album release show. I heard they're breaking up, so this is their last album release show. It's at the Woodshed, and they'll be playing with Totem and Taboo and Dust Bloom.
And Sunday, September 2nd, I guess you should do this one, and the Mondays as well. Will you just finish out the rest of the week for us?
Yeah. So on Sunday, I'd like to wish happy birthday to Billy Ditzig. He is one of our action sports writers and also helps coordinate our action sports events like Summer of Death and Slug Games. So happy birthday, Billy. And Monday, September 3rd, we have two birthdays. The first is videographer Brock Grossel. He can often be seen at Localized or at Craft Lake City events. Putting together a bunch of our films. He does a really great job. So happy birthday, Brock.
Definite proppers. That guy slugged it out many a night with me at Urban Lounge when we're doing Localized and we're trying to interview a bunch of rowdy drunk people. So special thanks to that guy.
Yeah, he helps us out a lot. And so does Stephanie Bouchard. She is on the marketing team and does a really great job with that and is a lot of fun to hang out with at events. So happy birthday, Stephanie.
Thanks, Esther, for dropping by today. I'd like to remind people that they can get more information about our daily calendar in the back of the magazine or at slugmag.com or on the iPhone apps. And you got to get out of here, but I wish you a good time in L.A. and a good time tonight.
Thank you, JP.
We recently watched as OK Akumi played our Craft Lake City Festival. The Utahn played his ethereal 8-bit music project to a rapt crowd. Carl Jorgensen, the man behind the project, started in late 2009, releasing several 3-inch mini CD singles until his debut full-length album, 12/20, came out in January of 2010. In July, OK Akumi released his third full-length album, Alpine Sequences. From that album, here is Valley Tones. That was OK Akumi's Valley Tones off his third full-length album, Alpine Sequences. For more music and other information on the project, check out okakumi.com. That's okikumi.com. In April of 2012, the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control approved a measure that doubles the handling fee from 42 cents to 90 cents per bottle. This raised prices on everything in liquor stores and breweries, which was immediately reflected in increased prices. Epic Brewing opposed the order, but still had to increase prices on their 22-ounce bottles. Slug writer Johnny Logan recently sat down with Epic Brewing's Dave Cole to discuss the charges and how it affects their business.
In the simplest terms possible, can you give us a breakdown of the measure? You know, what does it do? Who does it affect? That sort of thing.
Well, I think it affects everyone who drinks an alcoholic product in the state of Utah, that's for sure. It's just another measure, I think, in the end that ends up more or less being a tax on alcohol. It increases our cost to the cost of our product to the consumer by about 6 cents. So we, in fact, didn't raise our price to the state. They actually just added this doubled the cost handling. Now, in the 2 years that we've sold to the state, they've never touched this fee, and maybe it's a reaction to energy costs, which went up substantially a few years ago. I mean, the state is a fairly low cost, other than the tax rate overall on alcohol, but they're, in terms of handling the product, since they don't have a cold warehouse, they don't have people that know how to hand sell the product, they don't, you know, they, like you've heard in the newspaper recently, they focus on part-timers and all these people didn't get the raise that everybody else got. So they have this low cost structure in their system of distribution, but I mean, that's a big jump.
So kind of a sneaky little increase on taxes that they get a label as a handling fee?
Yeah, I would think so.
Now, how does this affect Brewery Paintins beside, is it just 6 cents as far as your beer goes?
6 cents on ours, it would be, might be slightly different on 12 ounce, but per ounce, it's probably gonna be pretty close. What it did significantly to us is it really played havoc with our line our pricing within the product. So things that were, you know, something 79 or a different price, 95 or whatever. It's just it's a small increase, but it's really a minor inconvenience.
Do you know how it will affect, you know, breweries in general, or how it'll affect Epic specifically?
Breweries in general and any other alcohol manufacturer in the state of Utah, of course, our price goes up. So people that consume alcohol responsibly in the state are paying more to do so again. And tourists come here and they're already shocked at the expensive cost of the products. So it's just another 6 cents more that looks bad. And you know, when you, through the way that Utah regulates strong beer and wine and liquor, restaurants have to pay the same exact price as the general public, and they have to make a markup on the product, obviously. They're in the business to stay in business and make great food and drink. So these prices at the visitor level that go to a lot of restaurants, when it starts to become ridiculous, because that 6 cents translates to 12 or 15, so it gets magnified down the chain. So I think that's really bad for Utah in terms of visitors.
Now, in a statement about the raised handling prices, Epic said that they've maintained the same pricing in Utah since opening, despite three major brewery expansions and the ever-increasing barley and hops costs. Why is maintaining a pricing structure important to Epic?
Well, it's important to, I mean, we're only 2 years old, and so it's important to say, hey, we're committed to bold, flavorful beers, and having that value there, too. I mean, it's already expensive enough for Utah consumers. I mean, it's not our intent to come and jack prices and do that, and, you know, it'd be nice if the state would give us some tax relief from the heavy burden, which makes up a large portion of the cost of the bottle. In fact, the state takes away the biggest check every month out of Epic. So, I mean, it's not our intent to do that. And as we grow, we've actually seen some economies of scale, which have helped us a little bit. So what I mean by that is we purchase a lot of malt from English. It's a Maris Otter two-row, wonderful malt, one of the most expensive malts in the world. Mm-hmm. Although malt prices went up significantly last year because our volume of malt went up, actually we ended up paying about the same, because we had some economies of scale, we're able to bring in full container loads of malt. So, I mean, if costs go up in the future, obviously at some point we'll have to pass them along. But right now we're in that stage where, yeah, we can support the Utah market, look for more support back from the government.
Well, we'd like to support you. As far as the brewery goes, do you guys have anything new in the back you're working on?
We just installed the two new 80 barrel fermenters. So that more than, it's about a 33% increase in the production of beer right here in this footprint. And the two or three new bright tanks that helps in the packaging side. So that's exciting. Great fall releases. Keep your eyes open for that. Return of the Big Bad Baptist, or the Resurrection, I like to call it.
Excellent.
And, you know, we're still working through the issues with the city zoning and the neighborhood to try and build additional warehousing to the north of the existing building. I think we're pretty close, so that's exciting if that happens. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Epic Brewing is located at 825 South State Street in downtown Salt Lake City. For more information on the brewery, go to epicbrewery.com. Thanks for listening to another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. Did you know the Melvins are gearing up to set a world record by playing a show in every U.S. state and Washington, D.C.? What are your thoughts about their record attempt? Call in and tell us what you think of the band's challenging tour. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com with that info, or call and leave us a voicemail on our automated line at 858-233-9324. We may just play you on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan, with associate producers Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and JP. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Our main logo and art design is by T-Done, and technical design by Kate O'Connor. On next week, The Melvins, a fall movie preview with Slug film critic Jimmy Martin, and Salt City Sirens.